And our sermon text this day is found in Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verses 1 to 18. And you will find this in your pew Bible, page 556. Ecclesiastes 7, 1 to 18. A good name is better than precious ointment, the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Say not, "Why were the former days better than these?" For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. In my vain life I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this from that. Withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Counterintuition, that's the title of our message today. Much of the stuff, as you'll see as we go through it, is counterintuitive, especially to the worldly. John Crosan is a production efficiency consultant for American industry. He contributed an article to the website for Maintenance Technology. Doesn't that sound like an exciting website? Maintenance Technology, in which he delineated four counterintuitive measures that all industries could take to improve plant efficiency. I worked several summers in college at a steel yard in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So I saw some of this up close. I was not one of their most productive workers, by the way, at this time. So I know precisely what they're talking about. They're counterintuitive, these measures, and so rarely adopted, though they're recommended and proven by Crosan and his associates, precisely because they fit the classic pattern of what appears on the surface to be the very definition of counterintuitive. A thing that is counterintuitive is contrary to what we would intuitively expect, so says Merriam-Webster. Contrary to what we would intuitively expect. Well, what is it about maintenance technology that could possibly be counterintuitive? Well, he gives us four examples. And some of you who are shade tree mechanics will understand this as well. He says, replace parts before they actually break or even begin to exhibit problems. Replace parts before they actually break or even begin to exhibit problems. Intuitively, we all say, I'm Dutch. I don't do this. Why not use a part until it's worn out, broken, and get your money's worth out of it? Well, in the context of a production plant, Crosan and his team have documented that time and money are lost in the machine's downtime, parts being out of stock, maybe collateral damage to a machine when parts fail, and compromise safety to workers when machines fail due to worn parts. Croissant says he has had difficult discussions, his euphemism for arguments and contrariness, difficult discussions with managers over these issues. Secondly, he says, take your best mechanic out of the work pool to do administrative work planning. Now, you know, any white-collar boss is going to say, what? Take your best mechanic out of the work pool to do administrative work planning. Croissant calls an urban legend the notion that administrative work has less value than actual work on the floor of a shop. He's found that taking one out of a pool of 10 mechanics, that is the best one, and having him plan and schedule work for the others, he says, raises, and I quote him, the group's productivity by the equivalent of adding 6 mechanics. He's demonstrated this. Thirdly, he says, encourage mechanics to spend time on inspection instead of repair work. Oh, I can hear the roars of protest now from the white-collar guys. This is hugely counterintuitive, isn't it? But it is what Croissant calls proactive maintenance. The mechanics are the very people with the skills and insight to know when parts need replacement or quality failures are occurring, and if defined levels of deterioration have been reached. Fourthly, he says, have mechanics document what they did. And you can hear the mechanics wail on this one. That can't be right, can it? Most guys on the floor absolutely hate data entry and know it's a waste of time because management never uses it, do they? Well, Croissant, this says this is the key part of the equation. Managers have to use the information. When people see that the information given by guys on the floor is actually used to make a job easier, maybe, or solve a problem, or show a need for further training, and the guy is involved in the process, the mechanic, then it has value, and it makes a difference. Well, having worked in this steel fabrication plant in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Haven Bush Steel, for many of my college summers, seeing plant efficiency up close, and we'd always snicker when the white-collar guys would come down and talk about plant efficiency. I'm not sure that any of my bosses would have taken this advice on any of these points. They wanted their best mechanics turning wrenches, tightening belts, frowning over silent lathes and presses and dies that could only be revived by their magic touch. The last thing they wanted Burton doing, Burton was one of my favorites at Haven Bush. Did you know we helped build the Sears Tower? So those steel girders and joists, many of them in the Sears Tower, were put together, fabricated by us. It's a scary thought, isn't it? And he would crawl right up into the bowels of a die to fix it, old Burton would. And the last thing the white-collar guys wanted was him walking around with a clipboard, inspecting stuff, or up in the office, drafting maintenance schedules. So all of these things, counterintuitive. And I trust that many manufacturing plants adopt Croissant's measures. They'll be more efficient, saving money and labor, as counterintuitive as they may seem to us. Well, as counterintuitive as these examples may seem to anyone who has worked in any phase of manufacturing, Koheleth lays before us some examples from wisdom that are also counterintuitive, especially to the worldling who has no experience with the living God of the Bible. Let's take a few minutes to look at, you have three brief points there that I'd like to expand upon just a little bit in our time here. First of all, from verses 1 through 4, the inside flap of your bulletin, you'll find a brief outline. Counterintuition. While covenantal wisdom teaches levity, while conventional wisdom, not covenantal wisdom, while conventional wisdom teaches levity over gravity, biblical wisdom is counterintuitive. Biblical wisdom is counterintuitive. Now, most translations will reflect for you that the structure of these verses, we have ourselves a brace of proverbial sayings. You see these laid out for you. All with a common theme. Not everything that passes for conventional wisdom stands the test of biblical wisdom. Not everything that passes for conventional wisdom in the world stands the test of biblical wisdom. Verse 1 is Exhibit A. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. Now, this verse is constructed along a chiasm as well, where the points can be plotted at the tips of the Greek key, the Greek X. Now, many of you know we've been introduced to chiasm time and time again. I've been instructing you on this time and time again, so I didn't give you a diagram this time, but you know what a chiasm is, and the points are plotted out on the various tips of the Greek key, or X. A good name is connected with the day of birth, when a child is named, of course. And precious ointment is connected with the day of death, when, of course, the body is bandaged and bathed in ointment, is it not? So they're connected by more than theme as well. The counterintuitive nature of them kicks in when we consider what the worldly conventional wisdom tells us about them. Oil is good, is it not? And so is life. Oil is good, and so is life. Having dry skin myself, a tendency to eczema, I know the value of oil and ointment to the skin. Oh. Besides the worldly wisdom of oil and ointment, Hippocrates developed a honey ointment too, by the way, to clean sores and ulcers and wounds. The Romans had a blessing that went, "May the ointment of honey drip upon you." A Roman blessing. And then, of course, in chapter 9, verse 8, we will encounter, "Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head." So it's a sign of blessing to be bathed in oil. The Targum has a reflection on this. That is the exilic Jewish commentaries. And the rabbis would reflect in this manner from the Babylonian Targum, "At all times let thy garments be washed and pure from the stain of sin. Acquire a good name, which is likened to the oil of anointing, that blessings may be called down upon thy head and goodness not forsake thee." You can see the language then borrowed from the Proverbs and from this text as well in the Targum. Well, there's a parallel to life here and its commencement too. When life holds all of its promise right at birth and hope for a young life, conventional wisdom. Isn't this better than death, really, of the empty object of a good name? Secondly, a good name is amorphous and death is final in conventional wisdom, isn't it? A good name is amorphous, be practical, and death is final under conventional wisdom. If the world is full of fools, as Koheleth has been telling us, and the memory of man is brief, already back in chapter 2, verse 16, he said, "Of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten." How the wise dies, just like the fool. Seems cynical on its face, but of course we teased that out. It wasn't quite, was it? But that's conventional wisdom. Additionally, death is final, cuts off any hope for the living. How can Koheleth possibly be serious here then? Many commentators have speculated on this. How could Koheleth possibly be serious here then? Is he joking? Being ironic, maybe? After all, he will declare unequivocally in chapter 9, verse 4, "He who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion." Apparently, life under any circumstance is better than death. Are we beyond hope of ever taking Koheleth seriously if he's prone to be so contradictory? And many commentators and theologians have come to that conclusion and just thrown up their pencils and their laptops and said, "Forget about this book." Well, the fool does walk away and think he's concluded finally on Ecclesiastes. Now, Solomon has already keyed us on how to approach him. He says, "For everything there is a season," back in that pivotal chapter, chapter 3, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven." That is, there's an apt time. That's been one of the themes of this book, hasn't it been? The apt time. The appropriate time for anything given under heaven. War, peace, hate, love, whatever it may be. There is an apt time for a good name. Proverbs 22:1 says, "Choose a good reputation over wealth. Better than silver and gold is being well esteemed." Those of you who depend on your reputations for business, for your incomes, for your well-being. What brings a business more business? In a free economy, at least. Good quality, skill, right? A good product, perhaps. But the word of mouth reputation as well, of honesty, integrity, and value? Or is it the reputation of being shady, unreliable, and dishonest, huh? In life, there are apt times when a good reputation, which seems on the surface so invisible and fleeting, difficult to lay one's hand on, the fool says, forget it, I will just get all I can while I can. No, the good reputation is better than precious ointment, Solomon says. This contrast is highlighted with a birth and death contrast too. The day of death is better than the day of birth. Koheleth, how morbid, how dreary and depressing you are. Is he on a death trip, like we'd say in the 60s, right? Is he only a type C personality with a death wish that would say such things? No. Koheleth has already articulated, see, he expects us to maintain consistency. And remember what we've read the day before, the paragraph before. He's already articulated several situations under which death is better than life. And he was serious about it. He says, if a man fathers 100 children, you remember from last week, and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say a stillborn child is better off than he. We saw this last week. He goes on to explain that this is because the stillborn child, dead, at least has peace and rest that the rich man does not. And then back in chapter 4, verse 2, he says, I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. So he's keyed us already. He's flagged these things for us. And he's returned to them. He's come and gone from them, but he's returned to them. Do you think he might return to this theme yet in the book, huh? I think maybe we'll see this again. I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. And that was in the context of severe oppression. We'll see the theme of oppression again today as well, where the powerless had no comfort and no hope of redemption. He goes on then to underline this brief chiasm with two parallel truths. Verses 2 to 4. I want you to look at these carefully. Verses 2 to 4. They have two parallel truths as bread in a sandwich, if you will, with a proverbial slice of meat at the center, verses 2 to 4. Verses 2 and 4 act as the bread with verse 3 at the center as the meat. It is better to go to the house of mourning, you see in verse 2, and then in verse 4 you see the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. So the house of mourning serves as the bread theme, if you will, for what's in the center there in verse 3. Sorrow is better than laughter. Okay, but they all are bound together, aren't they? The overriding theme in these three verses is that there's more wisdom in gravity than levity, because it brings you into direct contact with the chief issues of life. Gravity is better than levity because it brings you in direct contact with the issues of life. Keep this in mind as you go about your week. It's better to go and see a grave than a knave, a corpse at a memoriam than a comedian in an auditorium. It is better to weep at a Monday morning death than laugh at Saturday Night Live. Solomon wishes to underline for us that wisdom is with the undertaker, not the merrymaker. I love to laugh myself, don't we all? Remember in chapter 2, verses 1 to 2, where Solomon said, go ahead, let me test you with pleasure. Laughter is madness, is his conclusion. My two favorite comedians are Jeff Foxworthy and Bill Cosby. They both make me laugh until my sides hurt, and they don't ambush me with obscenity either. For example, I realized with Jeff Foxworthy that I might be a redneck when I had more pickup trucks than kids, more dogs than pickup trucks, and more guns than all of them combined. You might be a redneck in that case. Over the years, I've become an Idaho redneck. I love it. But all of the laughter fades into the far distance when at night, when I lay my head on the pillow, I realize that I too one day will die. I will cease to exist in this realm under the sun, as Solomon has been characterizing it. The most recent funeral I attended was that of Ginger's sister over the summer. It reminded me that this is the end of all mankind, including me. So I did as Kohela suggested. I laid it to heart. What do men think about when they lay their head on the pillow at night? What do you think about? What do I think about? What does the atheist think about? I love this quote from C.S. Lewis. He says, "Just as the Christian has his moments when the clamor of this visible and audible world is so persistent and the whisper of the spiritual world so faint that faith and reason can hardly stick to their guns," he says. Just as the Christian experiences that, C.S. Lewis goes on to say, he says, "So, as I well remember," because he used to be an atheist, did he not? "So, as I well remember, the atheist too has his moments of shuddering misgiving and of an all but irresistible suspicion that old tales may after all be true, that something or someone from outside may at any moment break into his neat, explicable, mechanical universe," he says. Koheleth would have understood that. That's precisely what he wants the worldling to do. This is an evangelistic book, is it not? I've been exhorting that upon you for weeks now. Ecclesiastes is an evangelistic book because it is one the worldling will resonate with right away. Koheleth wants the worldling, the fool, the one who ill considers the upper realm, to shudder with misgiving, to begin to suspect that old tales may be true, that someone from the outside is indeed going to one day break into his universe. It will come upon all men. And eventually, we will all repair to eternity versus modernity. This we must face if we are wise and not fools. The whisper of the spiritual world is a little more audible at places like funerals, less likely to be drowned out than at the bar or party. The wise take time to meditate, to hear the whisper, to consider the soft voice of God's word ministered by His Holy Spirit, and they lay it to heart. The fool? The fool, his heart is merry. "I don't have time for that. You're depressing." His heart is in the comedy club, the sports bar, the mosh pit, the house party. His heart and mind are trying to drown out that voice, squash the echo of the distant whisper of truth. I love what Oliver Goldsmith says. He says, "A loud laugh speaks the vacant mind." A loud laugh speaks the vacant mind. Not too loud. No, don't laugh too loud. And I love what Lord Chesterfield said. He says, "The vulgar often laugh, but never smile." Think about that. The vulgar often laugh, but never smile. What does it take to do either? So be wise. When your day of reckoning comes, will it take you by complete surprise as if you never expected it to happen to you? Or will you have considered it, prepared for it, such that you are found in a Savior? As we've read today, teach us to number our days, as we sang, right? As we sang, teach us to number our days so that we will grow in wisdom. He takes up some other counterintuitive things in verses 5 to 14. Let's turn to this. general theme here as well. While conventional wisdom teaches self-assertion is better than reticence, biblical wisdom is counterintuitive. Conventional wisdom teaches self-assertion is better than reticence, but biblical wisdom is counterintuitive here. The general theme that binds these verses together is that of petulant, unthinking, brash self-assertion versus the considered steps of the wise. The considered steps of the wise. Now the world admires and follows the brash, the confident, the aggressive, do they not? Julius Caesar in his Gallic Wars, I remember translating this with John in homeschool. Caesar says, aggression begets confidence. Skill and confidence themselves are an unconquered army, he says. And indeed, he moved across Gaul with this unconquered army of aggression and confidence. We, our own world, has men like this too, don't they? Donald Trump, he's been in the news quite a bit. Donald Trump says this, when someone challenges you, fight back, be brutal, be tough. Donald Trump, in reflecting on himself too, says this about himself. Love him or hate him, Trump is a man who, he's speaking in the third person, don't you hate that when people do that? Love him or hate him, Trump is a man who is certain about what he wants and sets out to get it, no holds barred. Women find his power almost as much of a turn on as his money. Donald Trump on himself. Ego, self, aggression, power, no holds barred action. This is the American way, isn't it? But is this necessarily a good thing in all circumstances, eh? Well, Koheleth quietly, eloquently protests. First of all, in verses 5 through 6, better to listen to a reasoned critique than drown an error in laughter. Verses 5 and 6. Better listen to a reasoned critique than drown out an error in laughter. Men flee to entertain themselves to better forget themselves in laughter, especially when they can laugh at somebody else. For a split second, the fool feels better about himself when he can laugh in ridicule at another man. This mocking, scorning ridicule is especially sad and foolish, isn't it, when you hear it? We heard it at the foot of the cross. We hear it in the bars and in the clubs all over the country. It sounds precisely like Koheleth describes it here, like the crackling of thorns under a pot. Right? And rather than try and forget what a fool you've been all day by singing the song of fools at night in the club to drown out the still small voice, why not listen to a wise man's critique of your behavior? Consider, as our text counsels us to, consider his rebuke. Proverbs speak eloquently of this too, don't they? I love Proverbs 25:12 because it has an apt picture. It says, like an earring of gold, and of course we hear with the ears as well. He says, like an earring of gold or ornament of finer gold is a wise man's rebuke to a listening ear. Secondly, verses 7 and 8 as well. Better to patiently await God's justice than succumb in despair to injustice. Verses 7 and 8. Better to patiently await God's justice than succumb in despair to injustice. When you're raised to be honest and free, and your parents have done their best to instill integrity into your heart, it's a bit disconcerting to discover just how corrupt the real world is once you get out into it. We've got kids we're about to launch into the world, aren't we? Megan, Yesica, Keziah. Once they get out there, this, as our kids came back and said, Dad, you told me about some of this stuff, but man, just seeing it out there. It is, in fact, as Solomon characterizes it for the wise, surely oppression drives the wise into madness. You get your first job and you find out everyone but you cheats and steals and lies and cuts their co-workers down. You persist in your integrity. Maybe you finally achieve a post of responsibility, judge, mayor, police chief, a CEO of a company maybe. And you find that everybody else is on the take for doing favors. And the temptation is strong. A bribe corrupts the heart, Kohelet says. The temptation is strong, but a bribe does corrupt the heart. Kohelet counsels wisdom. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. These two are related together. God will bring everything into judgment. Remember, we read from Psalm 73 today, did we not? When I thought how to understand this, David says, he talks about the evil and the corruption, the unrighteous man prospers, the wicked prosper, and the good die young. When I thought how to understand this, David says, it seemed to me a wearisome task until when? Until I went to the comedy club and heard Jeff Foxworthy? Until I went to the local party and got drunk and had a vision? No. He says, until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then he got perspective. He says, then I discerned their end. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you, David exclaims, but for me it is good to be near God. The bottom line in these matters is the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. The proud in spirit will fall. They will take that bribe. They will throw up their hands and say, what's the use? And they will go along. They get along. But the wise man is patient in spirit. God will bring all to justice. Thirdly, verses 9 and 10. Better to labor in the present for the future than bitterly dwell on the past. Verses 9 and 10. Better to labor in the present for the future than bitterly dwell on the past. Oh. Is there a person, a place, or a time in your life that just to hear a name, a date, or a location maybe calls up all the fear and the anger and the rage and the sense of betrayal of that time? Perhaps you were abused by a relative, or cheated on by a spouse, or lied about by co-workers and friends, or cheated by somebody that you trusted. You think about it every day. And when you do, you feel this anger and indignation rising in your breast. You can't help it because you know that since then your life has not been the same, has it? Why were the former days better than these, you exclaim? Well, it is this corrosive anger that he's talking about here, this corrosive anger that fools let nurture grudges and resentments that end up destroying the angry man, do they not? And those around him, for that matter. And your enemy still has the best of you because he's still destroying you with that hatred and anger and resentment every day. Destroys you more than your enemies, does it not? Some of you know precisely what I'm talking about. And this is what Solomon means when he says that anger lodges. Lodges. Other translations in other contexts, stick or dwell or settle or even nest. Deuteronomy 28:21 uses this word as well in the Hebrew. The Lord will make the pestilence stick to you. The Lord will make the pestilence stick to you until it has consumed you off the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Same word used here. Anger lodges in the breast of the fool. Rather, give the past and its anger to the Lord. Practice. Begin to labor. Consider the future in the present time. And know that if you must ask, why were the former days better than these, then you automatically are not asking from wisdom. Fourthly, then, verses 11 and 12. Better the security of wisdom than the risk of folly. Verses 11 and 12. Better the security of wisdom than the risk of folly. Kohelet employs the metaphor of an inheritance as an advantage, a protection. And surely, what a good start a young person can make if he makes wise use of an inheritance. In a free market capitalist economy, he can improve immeasurably his circumstance for himself and those that come after him. What an apt metaphor, too. What better inheritance can one receive than wisdom and knowledge, too? That's the freight that this metaphor carries. Solomon himself was hoping to pass on this rich inheritance of wisdom and knowledge through this book, intended to help them provoke in their thinking wise behavior for a king. Proverbs 14 says, "The simple inherit folly, but the prudent are crowned with knowledge." And wisdom proclaims, remember personified in Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom proclaims, "I walk in the way of righteousness, in the paths of justice, granting an inheritance to those who love me, filling their treasuries." Better the security of wisdom than the risk of folly. Verses 13 and 14. "Better to take your varying fortunes as from God than to impetuously despair over it." People do, indeed, when they despair, they do impetuous things, do they not? "Better to take your varying fortunes as from God than impetuously despair over it." Verses 13 and 14. Verse 13 is a proverbial statement of God's sovereignty. Who can make straight what God has made crooked? When it talks about God being crooked, it is not that God is dishonest and deceiving, but rather that he has ordained the path of the future, and no man can labor against his will. Crooked has more to do with the winding difficulty than of tracing God's path out in these things. If you think your GPS has trouble giving you directions, GPS on God's will gets it wrong every time. And as such, the wise man will consider the work of God in the light of this sovereignty. The wise man will consider the work of God. That's been a theme throughout these verses. And if he does this, he will enjoy and relish his prosperity and roll with the punches during the hard times too. Rich men who became poor in a day leapt from their office windows during the stock market crash of 1928. My own father saw women and children leap from the cliffs of Saipan rather than be captured during the invasion of that island by America in World War II. Japanese officers told them that American soldiers would eat their babies and keep them in slavery. So rather than surrender, they jumped off the cliffs in Saipan. And right in Yukon, in our own community, an elderly husband, just over a year ago, an elderly husband shot his wife and then himself because his retirement funds were depleted and all he had was Social Security. Rather than these rash, impetuous behaviors when things get desperate, Solomon counsels wisdom and the thinking through beforehand, i.e. consider, that there will be a variety of fortunes in anyone's given life. And then Koheleth brings an even more nuanced sense to overreaction. It is not always one way. It can be an evil ditch on either side of the road. Brings us to point three. Verses 15 through 18 bring to light another counterintuition. While conventional wisdom teaches excess over moderation, biblical wisdom is counterintuitive. Koheleth tests our patience and our own wisdom. He shakes us up a bit just to see whether we're paying attention or not. Don't be overly wise or foolish. Don't be overly wicked or righteous. Koheleth, here you go again. What in the world is he doing? Some conclude Solomon has lost all moral bearing, and he's a complete fool himself. This is one of the takes on Ecclesiastes. Others say Solomon is being ironic. That's the easy excuse for all of these texts. Solomon is just merely, sometimes he is being ironic, but not here. He's at maybe being tongue-in-cheek, something along these lines. But once more, the fool will go off half-cocked with this language, forgetting everything that Koheleth has laid down, and take this language at face value. So do not be such a fool. The key to understanding these verses is right in front of us in verse 15. I have seen everything in my life. I have seen everything in my vain life. Now, what do we mean by vain? Does that mean empty, right? Dramatic, empty, meaningless, existential. Is that what he's talking about here? Now, if you've been with us for a while, you know. This is not what it means, right? The literal translation of that is vapor, vaporous, brief, in other words. You know that he has been carefully establishing the relevance, the meaning, the fulfillment of life, hasn't he? All through this book, while gradually pointing to that which lies above the sun, by elaborating those things under the sun. What is so despairing time and time again and frustrating about it all is its brevity in my vaporous life, in my brief, fleeting, vaporous life. Nothing lasts. Even his observation regarding the righteous and the wicked has to do with time. The righteous man's time is brief, while the wicked man's is prolonged, isn't it? Prolonged, but not forever. And if we can put this in a contemporary term, Koheleth is counseling an economy of scale. All employed with wisdom. Not moderation exactly, because wickedness and folly should never be indulged to any extent. They should be avoided at all costs. The reason the righteous perishes in his righteousness is because all of his time was spent in the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom and not in the enjoyment, the relish, the use of them. This indeed would be the lot of who in the New Testament? As you look back on your experience with the New Testament too, who were those who spent so much time being righteous, so much time being wise that they ended up being fools? That's the lot of the Pharisees. And this is precisely the kind of man that Koheleth is describing here. They did not spend enough time in Ecclesiastes, apparently, the Pharisees. Jesus took the time to be wicked, quote-unquote, when he shucked grain in his hands, remember, on the Sabbath, as he walked through the fields with his disciples. The Pharisees accused him of being unrighteous, of breaking the law. Jesus took the time to be wicked in Koheleth's sense of the term when he healed the sick man on the Sabbath and was likewise accused of breaking the Sabbath. How did Jesus respond? He says, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Jesus took the time to be wicked in the sense that Ecclesiastes is getting at here when he went to dinners at the homes of sinners and tax collectors, such that he was accused of being a drunkard, right? Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they said, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. In fact, this wider context is perfect for understanding this text. Let's turn to it for just a minute in conclusion. Matthew chapter 11. 16 to 19. The Pharisees, those who had spent all of their time being exquisitely righteous, exquisitely wise, and ended up being fools, did they not? 11:16 to 19, but to what shall I compare this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to their playmates, we played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We sang a dirge, and you did not mourn. For John came neither eating or drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom, once again the theme of wisdom here, is it not? Yet wisdom is justified by her deeds. The Pharisees are the fools who are too wise, too righteous, such that their overweening pride indeed makes of them the very byword by which they're named, Pharisees, hypocrites. While John and Christ are wise because, why? Why are they wise? Because one is an ascetic and the other debauched? No, because both have their time, do they not? Once again, exquisite aptness is at work here. Exquisite wisdom to know when to do what. John was an ascetic, if you will, living in the desert eating locusts, dressed in crude animal skins. Jesus, on the other hand, eating, dining, drinking with sinners and tax collectors. But even Jesus said, the day will come when my disciples will fast. Wisdom tells you when what is apt, what behavior is apt, and what is foolish. Wisdom then is justified, borne out, demonstrated to be of God, demonstrated to be of God and of Christ, demonstrated to be wise by her deeds. So while Koheleth and his generation looked for the one who would be exquisitely wise, Who would know the apt time for everything, in every season? It wasn't any of them, was it? It was this one, rather, Jesus the Christ. Wisdom is justified by her deeds, and you, dear listener, are justified by him, in turn. It is his righteousness and his wisdom then that turns to save you. With that in mind, let us now come to that place where we find wisdom personified in Christ and Christ.